Chapter 16. Epstein, the patron of science and technology. In 2018, Epstein told the New York Times journalist James B. Stewart that he had dirt on prominent figures in Silicon Valley. Rather than the geeky images these tech leaders like to present, Epstein told Stewart they were actually hedonists who enjoyed drugs and sex. What's more, Epstein had himself seen these people taking drugs and ordering for sex. Given what we know about Epstein's sexual blackmail operation and his courting of prominent scientists and tech leaders, his admission to Stewart would seem to indicate that the sexual blackmail operation had shifted towards ensnaring these kinds of people after 2010. But why? And what did he hope to achieve from it? It's certainly true that Epstein made a concerted effort to surround himself with elite scientific minds in the 2010s. Names that have been connected with him include George Benford, George Church, Murray Gell-Mann, Stephen Jay Gould, David Gross, Stephen Hawking, Danny Hillis, Gerard Te Hooft, Stephen Kosslyn, Jaron Lanier, Seth Lord, Marvin Minsky, Martin Nowak, Oliver Sacks, Lee Smolin, Robert Trivers, Frank Wilczek, Roger Penrose, James Watson, Noam Chomsky, Lawrence Krauss, and Steven Pinker. Epstein courted the stellar names of the science world through science conferences, special dinners hosted at his various residences, trips to Little St. James, and most of all, funding, or the promise of funding. He met them through attending and hosting science conferences, and via John Brockman, a literary agent, whose authors include Richard Dawkins, Daniel Goleman, and Jared Diamond. Brockman acted as Epstein's PR man, according to journalist Yevgeny Morozov, telling him, "He's been extremely generous in funding projects of many of our friends and clients." At his dinner events, Epstein would hold court over an array of scientific talent. He would ask provocatively simple questions such as, "What is gravity?" Then sit back and watch the various minds at work. However, when the topic stretched beyond his interest or understanding, he would often blurt out, "What's that got to do with pussy?" Nevertheless, many of the scientists who knew him described Epstein as having a brilliant mind and, interestingly, fresh perspectives. How much of this admiration was induced by the promise of funding is hard to tell. But others saw through the masquerade. Jason Lanier, one of the founders of virtual reality, said that Epstein's ideas, while interesting, didn't amount to proper science. Like when he told the scientist that atoms behaved like investors in a marketplace. But if anyone disagreed with Epstein openly or highlighted his lack of understanding, he would become peevish. Cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker wrote about a meeting at Harvard where Epstein criticized efforts to reduce poverty and ill health because it led to overpopulation. When Pinker pointed out that better standards of living actually led to reduced birth rates, Epstein looked annoyed. Pinker was later told by a colleague that he was no longer welcome to Epstein's gatherings and had been voted off the island. But why was Epstein spending so much time, effort, and money courting these academic figures? One reason, perhaps, was his sexual blackmail operation. But it seems likely that there was more to it than that. Ego was certainly one factor. That Epstein thought of himself as a kind of a maverick genius is clear, and by surrounding himself with geniuses, he could keep up that particular delusion without ever really having to put it to the test. Yet ego alone can't explain all the millions of dollars Epstein spent. It seems rather that he was aiming to fund individuals and research that promoted his own, often controversial, ideas. These included, according to the New York Times, funding research on a particle that could trigger the feeling that someone was watching you. Then there was his ambition, cited by several guests at his dinner parties, to seed the human race with his genes by impregnating up to 20 women at a time at his New Mexico ranch. A plan that linked with his interest in eugenics, population control, and transhumanism. Epstein told several scientists that he was interested in perfecting the human genome and improving humanity through genetics. It was to this end that his Southern Trust Company was set up to analyze the DNA of residents of St. Thomas in the US Virgin Islands and sell the information to drug companies, netting $200 million in revenue and extensive tax breaks in the process. A charity set up by Epstein also donated £20,000 to the World Transhumanist Association to help research merging humanity with AI. Given his sometimes crackpot, often worrying ideas, not to mention his 2010 conviction for sexual offences involving minors, why did so many top-level scientists continue to associate with Epstein? The answer is money. As Stuart Peaver, one of Epstein's long-term friends and founder of the New York Academy of Art, said in an interview with Mother Jones magazine, Jeffrey had lots and lots and lots of dough. Scientists are always looking for lots and lots of dough, because most scientists spend most of their time writing grant proposals to raise money. Jeffrey didn't require a grant proposal. Jeffrey would promise money, and so they crowded around. The scientists who accepted Epstein's cash included the likes of Nobel Prize-winning physicist Murray Gell-Mann, who discovered the quark, Harvard mathematical biologist Martin Nowak, and MIT quantum physicist Seth Lloyd. Interestingly, one of the few scientists to refuse Epstein's money was a woman. Yvette Fuentes from the University of Nottingham was working on a novel method for detecting gravitational waves when she was asked by physicist Roger Penrose if she would be happy to accept funding from a convicted sex offender. Fuentes immediately said no. When she read the news that Epstein had been arrested in 2019, she called Penrose and asked if the mysterious patron was him. Penrose told her he believed it was. Reflecting on her decision, Fuentes told Science magazine, "The dream of my life is to build a gravitational wave detector and have it work. So if someone were to say to me, 'I'll give you the money to make your dream come true,' it would be very tempting to say yes. But then you have your ethical standards, even if you lose some opportunities. Saying no is the right thing to do. What Epstein has taught me is how important it is to do that." However, such ethical concerns don't seem to have troubled the majority of male scientists who accepted Epstein's funding. This was never better illustrated than with the academic institution Epstein patronized the most, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. MIT, and specifically the MIT Media Lab, headed by Joy Ito, took millions of dollars in funding either directly from Epstein or funneled through him after his Florida conviction. Even though Epstein was marked as disqualified in the university's official donor database, it continued to accept funding from him, consulted him about the use of the funds, and marked his donations as anonymous, according to The New Yorker, which obtained dozens of pages of emails regarding Epstein's links to the university. In fact, according to The New Yorker, the undercover nature of Epstein's link with the Media Lab was so widely known that the lab's head, Ito, referred to Epstein as Voldemort, or He Who Must Not Be Named. It turns out that Epstein had donated $1.2 million to the Media Lab in undeclared funds, as well as acting as an intermediary to secure funding from other rich donors. This included $2 million from Bill Gates and $5.5 million from Leon Black, two names which crop up around Epstein with suspicious regularity. Ito also visited Epstein several times at his residences, including two flights to Little St. James, and even invited Epstein to visit the Media Lab to inspect the results of his funding and meet with faculty members. The visit was criticised by an, again, female staffer, Sien Svensson, a development associate and alumni coordinator at the lab, who told Peter Cohen, the director of development and strategy, that she felt uncomfortable with Epstein's presence on campus. Svensson told The New Yorker, "At that point it hit me. This paedophile is going to be in our office." The paper reported that Cohen agreed and thought that Epstein was unsavory, but said, "We're planning to do it anyway. This was Joy's project." Epstein's name was kept off all documents about the visit, and certain staff members were instructed to keep away from the glass-walled office where the meeting was to take place. This was probably a good idea, as Epstein had the gall to turn up with two young female assistants, who he insisted came in with him. The appearance of the women brought home to Svensson the reality of the monster they were dealing with. She told The New Yorker, "They were models, Eastern European definitely. All of us women made a point to be super nice to them. We literally had a conversation about how, on the off chance they were not there by choice, we could maybe help them." Svensson resigned eventually because of the lab's relationship with Epstein. Ito likewise resigned, but only after the press revelations made it almost impossible not to. Alongside the courting of prominent scientists, there was another strand to Epstein's operation: getting in bed with the glitterati of Silicon Valley. There are few top names in the tech world that haven't been connected with Epstein at some point or other. They include Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla, Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook, Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, founders of Google, Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, former YouTube CEO Salah Kamanga, and of course, Bill Gates. Elon Musk is the pioneer of electric vehicles, reusable space rockets, and interestingly, regarding his connection to Epstein, the Transhuman Project, of linking human brains with AI. His ties to Epstein are numerous. He reportedly introduced Epstein to Mark Zuckerberg at a dinner hosted by Reid Hoffman. Musk was also photographed with Ghislaine Maxwell at the 2014 Vanity Fair Oscars party. Musk claims Maxwell photobombed the shot, but that seems hard to credit, when Musk and Maxwell clearly have half of the photo each to themselves. Even closer connections between Epstein and Musk appear to float beneath the surface. The New York Times journalist, James B. Stewart, described hearing rumours that Epstein was advising Musk on how to deal with the crisis caused by his tweet announcing he had secured the funding to take Tesla private. Stewart heard that Musk had authorized Epstein to search for a new chairman to replace him after he was asked to step down from the position. When Stewart visited Epstein's Manhattan mansion to chat to the tycoon, Epstein confirmed that he was working with Tesla. Epstein claimed he was trying to secure funding for the electric car company from Saudi Arabia, and said that Tesla and Musk would deny all knowledge of dealing with him, as his name was too toxic. True to Epstein's word, Tesla did deny all the claims. However, a later Bloomberg report confirmed that Tesla was indeed in discussion with Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, so some of Epstein's claims were verified. If there is a cover-up going on over Epstein's relationship with Musk, it doesn't compare in scope or size with the one hiding his links to Microsoft founder Bill Gates. Gates has repeatedly tried to play down his connections with Epstein. However, there is plenty of evidence to show that the two met many more times and were far more intimate than Gates wants us to believe. And that's just the official records. There is further evidence to show that the relationship went way beyond even that, as we shall see. According to the official story, Epstein and Gates first met on the evening of January the 31st, 2011. Given the time period, it's hard to imagine that Gates wasn't aware of Epstein's recent conviction and prison sentence. Another warning sign was the presence of Eva and Glenn Dobbin. Eva was the former Miss Sweden who had been Epstein's girlfriend in the 80s, and her husband Glenn was the man Virginia Giuffre said she was forced to have sex with after massaging the pregnant Eva. According to Gates' assistant, Bridget Arnold, the meeting started at 8 p.m. and lasted several hours. Following the meeting, Gates praised Epstein's intelligence and emailed colleagues saying, "A very attractive Swedish woman and her daughter dropped by, and I ended up staying there quite late." A sentence that sounds very suggestive. Whether what it suggests really happened or it was Gates just trying to titillate his colleagues is a moot point. This was the first of several contacts between Epstein and Gates that year. Soon after, attendees at a TED conference in Long Beach, California, spotted Gates and Epstein engaged in private conversation, according to the New York Times. And on May the 3rd, Gates visited Epstein's New York mansion, where he posed next to Epstein for a photo in the entrance hall. It was around this time that Epstein proposed working with Gates on a vast charitable fund for health projects around the world. Epstein envisaged a fund seeded by Gates Foundation money, supplemented by donations from Epstein's wealthiest friends. Epstein thought he could gain personal profit from the fund, raking off 0.3% of any money he raised. This didn't seem to put off Gates at first, who sent a team of delegates to Epstein's New York mansion in late 2011 to discuss the proposal. According to the New York Times, Epstein told the attendees, "If they searched his name on the internet, they might conclude he was a bad person, but that what he had done, soliciting prostitution from an underage girl, was no worse than stealing a bagel." According to the Times, some of the delegates were left feeling very uncomfortable about dealing with a sex offender. However, it obviously didn't put off Gates, who sent another team to New York in early 2012. On this occasion, Epstein told the team he had access to trillions of dollars of his clients' money, a figure so preposterous it left his visitors doubting Mr. Epstein's credibility, according to the Times. Gates and Epstein continued to meet throughout 2012. Then in 2013, Gates flew on the Lolita Express from New York to Palm Beach. 6 months later, Gates was having dinner in New York with Epstein again, discussing the Gates Foundation and philanthropic work, according to Arnold. In October 2014, Gates donated the $2 million to MIT Media Lab, which, as we have already seen, was funneled through Epstein. Soon afterwards, the relationship began to fizzle out, and the charitable trust venture never got off the ground. Epstein told a colleague that Gates had stopped talking to him, according to the Times. And Arnold told the paper, "Over time, Gates and his team realized Epstein's capabilities and ideas were not legitimate, and all contact with Epstein was discontinued." Whatever happened to the relationship, it had clearly been far more intimate than portrayed by Gates in the 3 years that it had lasted. We know from Epstein's Paris butler, Gabrielle, for example, that Gates, with his wife Melinda, visited Epstein's Avenue Foch apartment in the French capital. And the close relationship didn't just involve Gates, but two of his most trusted advisors as well. Melanie Walker joined the Gates Foundation in 2006 as its senior program officer after meeting Steven Sinofsky, a senior executive at Microsoft. But before this move, she had had a suspiciously close relationship with Epstein. The two had originally met after Walker graduated from the University of Texas. According to the New York Times, Epstein had offered to land Walker an audition at his boss, Leslie Wexner's modeling company, Victoria's Secret. If this sounds worryingly familiar, wait for what happened next. Walker moved to New York and stayed in an apartment owned by Epstein. Then when she graduated from medical school in 1998, Epstein employed her as his science advisor. Although Walker has never mentioned any sexual improprieties, it's hard to imagine, given the testimonies of Virginia Giuffre, Maria Farmer, and so many other women who had similar stories, that something untoward didn't go on. In any case, Walker remained friendly with Epstein and introduced him to another Gates associate. Boris Nikolich was the Gates Foundation's science advisor and a known close friend of Gates himself, having frequently travelled and socialised together, according to the New York Times. Nikolich and Epstein became close friends after their introduction, and Nikolich was present at many of the meetings with or organised by Gates. He can be seen in the photo taken at Epstein's New York mansion, standing alongside Gates and Epstein. Epstein and Nikolich became such good friends that Epstein named Nikolich a fallback executor in his will. Should either of the two main executives, Darren Indyke or Richard Kahn, be unable to serve? Nikolich declined and has, of course, publicly regretted his association with the paedophile. However, the strength of their relationship is there for all to see in Nikolich's nomination as an executor of Epstein's estate. As we can see, the bonds between Gates and Epstein are numerous, but even those don't do justice to the potential extent of the two men's relationship. There is evidence to show that Epstein and Gates not only knew each other, but were actively collaborating on projects at least a decade before the supposed first meeting in 2011. The 2001 Evening Standard article that we've already looked at in relation to Epstein and Prince Andrew contains a very interesting sentence with regards Gates. It reads, "He, Epstein, has made many millions out of his business links with the likes of Bill Gates, Donald Trump, and Ohio billionaire Leslie Wexner, whose trust he runs." As this was written in 2001, we can only assume that these many millions were made with Gates in the 90s, or perhaps even earlier. We've already seen that Ghislaine Maxwell's sister, Isabel, worked closely with Gates and Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen in the 90s through her internet companies like Magellan. Ghislaine was likely also involved in this company. So it is quite possible that Epstein came into close contact with Gates via the Maxwell sisters. Backing this up, we also have the testimony of Maria Farmer, who said she heard Epstein and Maxwell talking about Gates in 1995, as if they knew him well. If the relationship did go back that far, what did it involve? And how did Epstein make the millions that were supposedly linked to Gates? Given the Maxwell sisters' connections with Israeli intelligence, as well as Epstein's own, is it too far-fetched to speculate that Gates had some involvement as well? As we shall see, links between Silicon Valley and Israeli intelligence are not far-fetched at all, but the stuff of very worrying reality. Israel's Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has driven a clear policy of funneling ex-intelligence and military agents into tech startups, using their state-trained expertise to enhance private industry. These tech startups then export abroad, many of them to the US, where their state funding gives them a head start on rival fledgling companies. One of Israel's tech specialities is surveillance, learned from its heavy control over the Palestinian territories and the Gaza Strip. It then exports these surveillance methods to other countries, often ones with poor records on human rights. One such example is the Israeli-created Pegasus spyware. which it sold to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi government used the surveillance software to track the movements of dissidents abroad, and it was believed to have been instrumental in the murder of Saudi renegade journalist Jamal Khashoggi. But Israeli technology isn't only used by authoritarian regimes. Western countries, and specifically the US, are being flooded with tech startups staffed with ex-Israeli intelligence officers. It may come as no surprise that Epstein was involved in at least one of these projects. Carbine 911 is a mobile app which allows 911 call centers to track and monitor emergencies. If a Carbine user calls 911, the responder can get access to the phone's GPS and camera, and is provided with a live video feed from the phone. The system also cross-references the caller's identity with criminal databases and can access any data on the user's phone. According to the Carbine website, the same information can be obtained from any phone as long as it calls a 911 call center equipped with Carbine or even another phone that is connected to the Carbine network. Several countries in the US have already installed the software, and more could be coming online in the future. The implications of this technology for privacy alone are concerning. But when the list of people behind Carbine 911 is revealed, the possibilities become truly alarming. Epstein invested $1.5 million in the company through his friend Ehud Barak, former Israeli Prime Minister and head of its military intelligence services. Barak is a major investor in Carbine 911 and also acts as a frontman for the company, appearing on the likes of Fox News to endorse the product. Let's not forget that he was also the man who originally recruited Robert Maxwell to Israeli intelligence, and that he had a long-standing relationship with Epstein, visiting him on many occasions and turning up several times at Mark Epstein's 66th Street apartment, where the young MC2 models were housed. But the links to Israeli intelligence don't end there. Carbine's CEO, Amir Elakai, is an ex-Israeli intelligence officer. Co-founder, Lital Leshem, is an ex-operative of Black Cube, a private Israeli intelligence service. CIO, Alex Dizengoff, worked in cybersecurity for Israel's Prime Minister's office. And the company director, Pinchas Berkus, is an ex-brigadier in the Elite 8200 unit, which specializes in surveillance and signals intelligence. It is interesting to note that not one of the company's high-ranking staff, directors, or investors has any experience in emergency response, whereas most of them have ties to Israeli and US intelligence. Given all this, not to mention Israel's history of putting trapdoors into software such as Promise, you would be forgiven for suspecting that Carbine 911 isn't just about improving emergency response. Indeed, similar software, which was supposedly designed to report emergencies, is now being used in China to conduct mass surveillance on its population of Turkic Muslims. The phone app it used to track their movements and facilitate the arrest of possible insurgents on the mere suspicion that they might commit a future crime. This is the technology Epstein was funding, and it fits in perfectly with his role as an Israeli intelligence operative. It also casts a revealing light over Epstein's other endeavors in science and technology, and allows us to build a picture of his ultimate goals. These, I believe, were threefold. One, to ensnare prominent scientists and tech figures in sexual blackmail scandals where possible, although this side of the operation was winding down somewhat after the Florida arrest. Two, to fund Israeli infiltration into the US tech market, introducing technology that could be used for surveillance purposes and incorporating software fitted with trapdoors into existing US tech. And three, through schmoozing with pioneer scientific and tech elites to glean inside information on the latest US science and technology breakthroughs, which might aid Israel. What is perhaps more worrying is that even after Epstein's death, the Israeli technological infiltration of the US continues, and is even growing in pace. Epstein and Robert Maxwell would, I'm sure, be smiling if they could see the fruits of their labours.